At Pew, we have what's called the Fiscal 50 Project, and it's really focused on gaining a better understanding of the long-term fiscal trends that are impacting states across the country. So we track a number of key indicators like tax revenue trends and spending trends, as well as budget reserves. And then most recently, we've been trying to help readers better understand how events that you might see in the news also influence long-term trends within their state. So that's been an exciting development to be a part of as well.
So let's focus on, short-term, long-term implications of shifting federal policy changes. Where would you like to begin with that?
So I think it's important just to note that states were already heading into one of the toughest fiscal environments since early in the pandemic, with slowing revenue growth, rising costs, and a lot of economic uncertainty before H.R. 1 was enacted. And now we're seeing these federal changes not really create an immediate crisis for most states, but they do add to those underlying pressures by gradually shifting costs and responsibilities to states, especially in programs like Medicaid and SNAP. And it's really that combination of tightening budget conditions and shifting responsibilities that state budget offices across the country are trying their best to better understand and start managing right now. One encouraging part is that most states are entering this period from a position of relative financial strength. So most states have built up record high reserves, and they're doing more long-term planning than they've ever done before. That said, those sort of financial cushions, they are shrinking, and I'd say the margin for error is a lot smaller these days than it was just a few years ago.
So South Dakota has no state income tax. Our revenues have been flat. How does that compare with the rest of the state, or rest of the country, I should say?
Yeah, I'd say at a high level, South Dakota's sort of fiscal picture right now looks a lot like what we're seeing in many other states. Revenues have cooled from the sort of unusually strong growth during the pandemic, and the state's reserves are in a decent place, but they're not unlimited, of course. At the start of this year, tax collections were about $26 million below South Dakota's long-term trend, which lines up with the broader national slowdown in state revenues. And while the state had about $240 million in its rainy day fund, that emergency fund that states turn to when they're facing an unexpected budget challenge, $240 million, by the way, is about a month's worth of government operations for this state. That is below the national median, but it also means that the state has just sort of less cushion for budget pressures as they start to build, but it's still a relatively strong overall balance. So I would say that South Dakota isn't in a fragile position, but it also doesn't have endless room to absorb some of these new costs being shifted down from the federal level.
Are those new costs things that we're going to notice right away, or are they long-term pressures?
In some cases, they are costs that states have to start. These are expenses that states are going to have to start making right away. I think taken all together, South Dakota's exposure to some of the changes under H.R. 1 is actually more limited than in many states, but it's not zero. The state will face some very real administrative challenges in programs like Medicaid and SNAP as those federal requirements become more complex over time. But at the same time, the state avoids many of the biggest fiscal risks that we're seeing states grapple with elsewhere. Those are things like new limits on Medicaid financing mechanisms, these provider taxes, some of the SNAP benefit payment penalties, and issues around tax conformity. That's one way in which the state avoids some of those major challenges that other states are facing. For policymakers, the issue, kind of summing it all up, it isn't so much of this immediate budget hole. It's whether the state's administrative systems and operations can absorb some of these new federal mandates without disrupting coverage or the quality of services that people rely on.
Help me understand that more. In a Medicaid, for example, term, does that mean we have to take on more administrative tasks and therefore grow the state program a little bit? What exactly are we talking about here?
South Dakota is a Medicaid expansion state, which means that it's directly affected by the new work and reporting requirements and the more frequent eligibility checks required under HR 1. So those changes don't cut the program, but they do add costs by, you know, particularly for IT upgrades or for staffing that might be needed to really build up the capacity of the state to be able to implement these new federal mandates. And then one of the risks that we talk about in a few of our analyses is just how these changes can increase churn or the enrollees that might be inadvertently dropped off of their enrollment because they're asked to re-verify eligibility more often. That churn can really disrupt coverage, as I just mentioned, but also reduce federal dollars that flow to the state when people are still qualifying. And you've seen a lot of that in the news, and this is one way that it can kind of manifest in state financial disruption as well. Bottom line for Medicaid in the state is that the challenges that policymakers face are going to be more operational than structural in nature. So these are higher administrative demands, but the state largely avoids some of the strains on those financing mechanisms that I mentioned earlier that other states rely on more and therefore are affected more, but that don't apply to South Dakota.
How does the Rural Health Transformation Program wrap into all this or intersect with that?
The Rural Health Transformation Fund is $50 billion that was made available to states. Half the money is automatically awarded to the state, and then half the money is awarded based on a competitive process. So South Dakota would have applied for a portion of the remaining funds. The thing to look for is just how state leaders plan to use that money once it comes in. And a lot of the emphasis has been on trying to make sure that rural communities and rural hospitals are building up capacity and making sure that they have systems in place to hopefully avoid some of the effects of these other Medicaid changes within the state over time.
Let's talk about SNAP benefits. How is that shifting as federal policy shifts under HR 1?
There's two major components that relate to state budgets and to South Dakota. One of the biggest ones is that states for your listeners, it might be helpful to know that generally within the program, states and the federal government share the costs of administering these benefits. And that's really on a 50-50 basis for a long time. What happened in HR 1 is that the federal government is now requiring states to pick up 75% of the administrative costs. And so that's one big change. The second big one is that for the first time, states that have what's called higher payment error rates, payments that are miscalculated or somehow go out and they're inaccurate to beneficiaries, states that have those higher payment error rates are going to be required to cover the actual cost of the benefits themselves for the first time. Historically, the federal government picks up 100%. So now we're looking at least some states picking up a portion of those benefit costs. And in South Dakota, just like every other state, it will be picking up that extra 25% of the administrative costs. But the difference for the state compared to most others is that South Dakota has one of the lowest payment error rates across the country. And because of that, the state won't be required to start covering a portion of benefit costs, which is really the largest new financial challenge for most states when it comes to SNAP and the changes from HR 1. So South Dakota, SNAP is really about the new administrative costs to run the program and less about picking up the bigger cost share due to the payment error penalties within the bill passed earlier this summer.
Yeah. So when will that take effect?
So the new administrative costs for states will become effective in October 2026. So about midway through the next fiscal year.
Are there any other areas that you think are particularly relevant in the research that you're doing right now for South Dakota? Something we didn't talk about?
I would just say that one of the other components that most states are dealing with is this issue around tax conformity. And that's a really wonky term, but it just means how many states actually link the starting point for what everyone in a state, their tax liabilities. States will use federal definitions, for example, of income to determine, what you owe in state taxes. And because of that link, when you change federal tax policy, it can often lead to changes in state tax policy and more taxes coming in, or sometimes less taxes coming in. On the tax side for South Dakota, the state's actually largely insulated from these changes. It does not have a personal income tax or a corporate income tax, so these changes don't flow through to state revenues. But I will say that is a challenge that most other states are dealing with at this time. And in Colorado, for example, it had already created budget gap early in this fiscal year, soon after the bill was passed, so much so that the governor actually had to call a special session and deal with this $1.2 billion budget gap right away.
I want to close with the reserves. We talked about them a little bit throughout this, but we were talking again, our governor is proposing an increase in our budget reserves. Is there an ideal? Is there something that you're looking for percentage-wise, an average across the state? Help us figure out how to consider what our goal should be for essentially a rainy day fund.
There's no one-size-fits-all approach to determining a adequate reserve size for a state. There are a couple of guiding principles, though. One is you need to understand how your state's budget is going to respond to an economic downturn, for example, some sort of bad event in the future. And one way that you can do that is by doing a stress test. So some of the largest banks out there have to do this by law. But increasingly, we're seeing states adopt this practice where they kind of run a scenario of a garden variety economic recession, and they better understand how their state's taxes might fall, how their spending might have to increase, and what that difference looks like, what the budget gaps might look like. Letting that inform the size of your rainy day fund and the state's savings today to make sure you have enough in the future. It really depends on state leaders, their preferences for, okay, maybe we don't need to have a rainy day fund that reflects the entire size of that budget gap in the future. Maybe we want to be able to, very similar to how we all take out insurance policies for cars or our houses, and we're making decisions about how much insurance do we want to take out and have on hand for the future. So maybe a state wants to be able to cover 100% of the budget gap in the future, or maybe it's 25%, and they have a plan then to raise revenue or cut spending in order to fill in the remaining gap. But there's increasingly proven financial management practices like those stress tests, as well as doing longer term budget assessments that allow policymakers to gain a better understanding of their fiscal trajectory, if you will, and plan for those potentially harmful events in the future.